Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Helen.
I'm Stephen.
And today we have with us on the New Statesman podcast, Henry Zeffman, our acting Staggers editor, because this is a special extra bonus at no extra cost. Not that there is a cost anyway, but if there were, this would be at no extra cost.
Isn't the cost having to listen to
me talking about
advert?
Exporting, yes.
Oh, are we still on exporting?
But anyway, which is good. And do you know what? I'm in favour of exporting.
This is actually some good viral ambush marketing we're doing right now, isn't it?
But more importantly, just a special little quick hit, because we thought it'd be good to, now we've got the vast majority of the election results, I don't think there's anyone still dribbling in. I bet there's some council seat somewhere, that, let's be fair, that hasn't declared yet, that we can have a proper reflection on what they can tell us, which, as far as I can see, Stephen, is lots of different things in different places. There is no one narrative that you can pull out of these election results.
Yeah, no, I think that's broadly fair. I mean, I think that the one narrative you can pull out from it, from all of them, is that, and actually you can pull this out from the good results as much as the bad, is that Labour is not on course to win a Commons majority or anything like it in 2020, although the reasons are more interesting than the kind of Corbyn good, Corbyn bad kind of argument.
Yeah, well, I remember that the last election, I think it was Philip Cowley identified different strata, do you remember, of the population, and they had one that was liberal metropolitan elite, and this is 8% of, and these were the people who would have voted for the Greens, say, in London. Corbyn has got that vote bang up, hasn't he? Like, that's what one of the lessons, I think, from London and from Bristol, is that middle-class professionals who are quite affluent, who wouldn't mind paying a bit more tax, are fine, are really on board with the Corbyn project.
Well, and not just that too, you know, Crawley. So anywhere where you have a kind of middle class, public sector, professional base to draw on, and anywhere where people put wind chimes in their front doors, Labour is doing very well. I mean, if you plotted Labour's election performance onto the demographics of the United States, then you've actually got a fairly crushing landslide. I can't remember what it was since Suzanne Evans said when she was explaining why UKIP do badly in London, educated, cultured and young or something. Mm. And in all of the places where people are educated, cultured and young, all of the places which look like the Britain of the future, Labour has done very well, apart from in Scotland.
And this is going to help Labour in municipal elections for as long as Jeremy Corbyn is leader and probably beyond. They will always do well in city elections, which are essentially two-horse races. So in Bristol, that was a two-horse race between the Independent and Labour. And in London, that was between Labour and the Conservatives. But when it comes to a parliamentary election, all that really means is stockpiling votes in constituencies which Labour already hold.
I thought that was really interesting. Emily Thornberry did a good attempt at a kind of coming in line from it in a sort of pro Corbyn way, which was like, you know, well, these elections have been very difficult to kind of take any narrative from, but let's look at the London mayor election, which is the one straight Labour Tory contest in this. And you're kind of like, yes, that is a good way of looking at it, but quite a lot of elections, and certainly the next election for Westminster, will not be a straight Labour Tory.
Yes, I mean, that's actually all credit to Emily Thornberry with coming up with a sort of more sophisticated pro-Corbyn or not anti-Corbyn line than some of her colleagues, but no, that's nonsense.
But the other mayoral elections have been pretty good for Labour as well, haven't they? So Newcastle,
sure.
And Manchester. And these are
and Liverpool as well.
And these are positions that have actual real power, right? Before and after Devo Manc reaches its full fruition.
I mean, because the interesting thing is that for the moment, and my expectation is the SNP will take control of Glasgow Council next year, but at the moment, every great city don't write in. Every great city is run by the Labour Party. London, Manchester, Glasgow, Edinburgh.
Actually, Worcester's no overall control now, so you have, I've already debunked your thesis, Stephen.
Birmingham, Bristol. The fascinating place is Stroud, actually, which does not fit remotely the play. You should not have a Labour council, shouldn't really have had a Labour MP from 2005 to 2010. So it's a fascinating place, and I'm going to visit and write about properly at some
point. Be afraid, people of Stroud.
The other really interesting thing about Labour running all these great cities is they're not necessarily figures from Labour's left, from the Jeremy Corbyn tendency of the Labour Party, who have these great powers. So in London, Sadiq Khan
was always soft left,
although he appears to be on a journey towards Labour's centre-left, and I hope that's not too controversial, but the idea that he may be appointing Jackie Smith as his deputy mayor for policing, there might be a role for the arch Blairite Andrew Adonis in his city hall administration. I mean, that is a real...
I feel Andrew Adonis is a bit like a Pokemon or something, like everybody has to collect him.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to be the only person who knows how to make transport infrastructure happen, so I don't really know which Game Boy Color Pokemon game that's a level on, but he certainly completed it.
Pokemon game.
I've not played since Pokemon Red, so I don't
fight,
really
know. Fight, run, borrow to invest.
but sorry, the point I was making, aside from Pokemon.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail you.
No, that's fine. I was more of a Digimon man anyway.
I'm so old, I don't know what that
you
is.
Don't, no, Digimon was one which had the theme tune. Digimon, little monsters, Digimon are the champions. You don't remember that?
I can't believe that people aren't paying for this when there's a musical interlude.
The point
as well.
I was making before that luscious musical interlude is that this is a real opportunity for the centre-left of the Labour Party to show that they can govern. These cities can become sort of laboratories for policy innovation. And they can, while, as they would have it, the Labour Party on a national level in the House of Commons is messing about with unelectable proposals and irrelevant side issues, they can say, well, look, we are taking advantage of these new powers that George Osborne is giving us for whatever reason. And we are governing in interesting, innovative ways. We are ameliorating the impact of conservative policies on these cities. It's a really big opportunity for the Labour Party, even if it's not the route to electoral success. It is an opportunity to actually change the country. And if it's going to be as long until the next Labour majority government, as many of us think, well, this is an opportunity for people to actually do stuff in the meantime, even if it's at a local level.
The other sort of fascinating untold story of the locals was that everywhere which has had...
You can say Lib Dem fight back. Because there was a Lib Dem fight back, although we laughed last week.
I sneered at Lib Dem fight back, and I am going to eat crow. I was wrong. The Lib Dems had a lot of great results. They reclaimed third place from UKIP, which means they don't have to go through a playoff to qualify for the Champions League. they had a phenomenal set of results.
Tim Farron would beat Nigel Farage in a fight.
No.
Come on, Nigel Farage is really wheezy.
Yeah, but he'd just get a pint glass out of his back pocket and smash it over Farron's head.
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry, Stephen.
Farron would be fighting with a sort of twig or something.
Yeah, Farron would be turning the other cheek. Yeah, he's big into all of that stuff, isn't he? Like, anyway, if you have an opinion on who would win a fight, do tweet us. Everywhere which has had a devolved institution since 1999... turnout was either at or above its record level. Record turnout in London, record turnout in Scotland, record turnout in Wales. And in Scotland, the official opposition, let's not forget, in Scotland, the Conservatives now, were against the whole thing when it started. So the quiet success of devolution as a policy place which people have built into and are very enthusiastic. A lot of people like to say that the rising support for Scottish independence is a kind of argument against devolution. I find the idea that people wanting more power is an argument against giving them power a little bit suspect,
So one of the things I find really interesting about Scotland is obviously the way that you present the results, that the narrative is very much, you know, Tories kind of back from the dead, Labour is still bleeding away loss. You know, it wasn't a great night for the SNP, but from an extremely high watermark, so it's not like anybody can be rude to them, you know, only getting whatever it is, 45% of the vote. But there's no one, there is absolutely no one, as far as I can see, have picked up calling for Kezia Dugdale, the leader of Scottish Labour, to resign. Because people recognise that her job is enormously thankless and really difficult and will take a really long time, probably more than one electoral cycle, maybe more than two. They don't say that about Jeremy Corbyn, which indicates that for all everybody keeps saying Labour is incredibly unelectable at the next election, we can't see how there's a route back to power, they don't feel that sense of hopelessness that would then be kind of, you know, that would then...
I mean, I think a couple of things. I'd say, one, give it a week.
I just think, is there anyone actually left?
But I think it's more a function of hopelessness that no one is as yet bothered to call for Kezia Dugdale to resign. I don't think it's that they all think she's done a sterling job in tough circumstances. I think it's that
no one else
some of them just think the circumstances are so tough that it's kind of irrelevant who's in charge of Scottish Labour for now.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think the fact that, you know, Scottish Labour... are no longer bold men fighting over a comb, it's decapitated men fighting over a comb. But I think they will still be fighting over that comb a bit in the coming days, weeks and months. I think in some ways she did very lucky coming third. If she had come second, I think there would have been enough people who would have thought, oh, maybe, you know, maybe the tide's coming in for us. I quite like the idea of it. Now people are aware that there's a lot of flaw still to come. Because in some ways, some of the reaction to the Scottish result south of the border was a bit overwrought. And then people saying, oh, Labour needs to win Canterbury to win a majority of six or whatever. Well, they needed that anyway because the Scottish majorities were so big. And actually, in terms of Labour's Commons position in Scotland... this is a counterintuitive take, but if you look at the wards, it's true. It was actually quite a good night for them in Scotland because they won Edinburgh Southern, which shares most of the wards of Ian Murray's seat of Edinburgh South. We know from the Lib Dems, and if you can control every layer, then you represent...
He who rocks the council rules the world.
And, you know, they are still in power, albeit in coalition with the SNP on Edinburgh Council. So if next year they can win the seats in the Edinburgh South ward, they control it at a Holyrood level and they control it at Westminster, actually Labour's Scottish position in some ways is
from
is
a low baseline, doesn't get worse.
You're also totally right, Helen, to point out that devolution saved the Scottish Conservatives, not just by... the very fact of devolution, but by the electoral system that they're using. So the regional...
Don't explain the De Haan system.
I'm not explaining it, but my point, in as layman terms as I can understand, let alone anyone with a life, the regional vote kept Scottish Tories in Holyrood for ages. And this, but now that they've had Ruth Davidson as a list MEP, MSP, for example, raising the profile of the Scottish Conservatives and riding tanks and bulls, she has won a constituency seat.
Yeah,
and that's really interesting because having been saved by the regional seat, they now have the opportunity to become entrenched in a few Scottish Parliament constituencies, which may give them some hope of actually clawing back the odd seat in Westminster when it comes to 2020.
I think that all the talk about her coming down to Westminster is exactly the kind of thing that is calibrated to keep people voting for the SNP. Mm. Like, oh, you're having fun in your little parliament, but maybe you'll come down and like play with the big boys. Yeah. And I think it's a measure of maybe how people don't realise how much Scottish political culture feels, you know, people feel that the major decisions in their life often are being controlled in Scotland. They don't feel that they've got a kind of diddy, adorable Playmobil parliament.
That's right. I don't think it will happen, and I don't think it would work if it did happen. I think the instant she came and became the Conservative candidate for a safe seat in the home counties, that's the moment that her unique sui generis appeal is shattered.
But also, she's got no base. I mean, she'd be to be her kind of, you know, Davidsonites in the Westminster party.
Absolutely.
It's sort of one of those things where you just people say it and you kind of go, are you just saying that just so that you can say that you like her?
She's very close to the Work and Pension Secretary, Stephen Crabb, and it's far more likely that she would be an evangelist for a Crabb leadership campaign than that she would come down and try and assume that mantle herself.
I was just thinking for our own joy that if Stephen Crabb became Conservative leader, that would be like a headline writer's gift. Also, people's short names should definitely have more success in politics. It's just a lot easier to deal with.
That's true.
So Bush trumps Zethman.
Remember when people have like Blair Brown, Cameron is like sometimes the son has to go Cam. Like this is a real problem. If you were called something, if you had one of those like Sri Lankan names that goes on for 3 days, it would be very difficult for you to become British Prime Minister. Anyway, sorry.
That's Stephen, definitely the only reason. Yeah.
Stephen, I'm babbling.
Yes, but speaking of Stephen Crabb, who obviously is a Welsh MP, Wales.
Mm. Good segue.
Yeah, that was an amazing segue.
Keep going, right? You can do it. Come on.
Wales. So Wales was very interesting in that Carwyn Jones, the leader of the Welsh Labour Party, took a decision that lots of people, including myself, have been fairly critical of, in that he told canvassers not to talk about Europe on the doorstep. So in some parts of the country, people have been campaigning for both. Obviously, we're 7 weeks away from it. Now, obviously, that probably has set back the pro-European campaign in Wales. However, although UKIP did very well on the list, they did not do as much damage to the Welsh Party in the constituencies as we feared they might. So that decision appears to have been partially validated.
And UKIP got kind of the amount of assembly members that you would expect from their overall polling result. It's more a function of the fact that they've been kind of really brutally left out by first past the post at Westminster, right? Given that they're still polling 12%, they ought to have far more representation in our
And the whole point of the devolved general elections, I'm not going to bore on about de Hon, but the idea is what you effectively do is you have your disproportional first past the post roll, and then you use the list system to kind of correct slightly the disproportionality. They also did get lucky in that Plaid Cymru fought a very, I'm actually going to say, selfish campaign on the part of Leanne Wood. In that
she took out Leighton Andrews, didn't she? Leighton Andrews overturned quite a big majority of his.
It was an astonishing result. Swing. So 6,000 Labour majority is now a 3,000, which is seems very impressive, right? But then you look at the close run fights, which they lost narrowly, and you think about the amount of money they spent in the Rhondda getting their leader elected.
But this is exactly the argument that the Greens had at the general election about whether or not they were going to try and put all huge amount of resources into getting Natalie Bennett elected in. She ran against Keir Starmer, didn't she?
That's
in
right.
Hoban and St Pancras. Yeah. Or Caroline, you know, how much when you're a party like that should you try and get your leader into power?
Yeah, and I mean, I think with the Greens, it's very different because of first past the post. I mean, I think it was a mistake for Natalie Bennett to stand. But for the Greens, they basically have two seats and it's worth resourcing whichever Bristol seat it is, then Thangham Debonair
West
is the MP for Brighton and arguably Norwich South. I know I said two and I lied. whereas with Plaid, they had lots more winnable seats. Mm. They're now, to be honest, going to be fairly powerless in this parliament. The Welsh Labour Party is too short of a majority, but to be frank, it looks very difficult to imagine a situation in which all of those parties could combine against them. And I think that her approach of attempting to burrow out from Labour's left is not working very well for them.
Okay, I'm going to apologise to our listeners. I think we should skip Northern Ireland because I think it's fair to say none of us are Northern Ireland experts. We've had Siobhan Fenton writing on the website very well from that, so that's on the Staggers if you want to read it. But let's finish up with a little bit of London, just because I think there is a fundamental question, which is how is that Corbyn's victory or not?
Yes, it's Corbyn's victory, would be my take. Yeah, Sadiq Khan fought a very good campaign that I think probably did get him some votes from people who wouldn't have didn't want to vote for Jeremy Corbyn. However, if you look at some of the places, particularly what happened to the Green vote, particularly in the first round this time, there is that same effect you saw in Bristol, in Norwich. Big metropolitan centres are places where Corbyn's brand of politics does well. And so they kind of helped each other out a bit, I think.
I agree. I mean, I think if it had been narrower, you could have said, all right, well, Sadiq Khan has done a great job here broadening his own appeal, broadening the appeal of Ken Livingstone's coalition, expanding into the outer reaches of Boris Johnson's donut. I've really bastardised that metaphor. in Ealing and Hillingdon, he did very well. In Barnet, he probably lost fewer votes than because of Ken Livingstone's Nazi comments than he might have done if he'd taken longer to condemn him. You can see the effects of Ken Livingstone and Labour Party's last few weeks in some of the Greater London Assembly results. So Barnet and Camden's GLA seat was closer than it might have been, even though Labour retained it. But the big one is Havering and Redbridge, which it's astonishing that Labour came so close to winning, but a reflection of various things, including the bedroom tax. But Labour came very close to winning, didn't win it. Wes Streeting, who's the MP for Ilford North, which is one of the Westminster constituencies included in that, tweeted quite explicitly, Ken Livingstone has cost us this Greater London Assembly seat. But I think I agree with Stephen, that the broader London picture is that people who otherwise would have cast votes for the Green candidate, Sean Berry, were very happy to cast them for the Labour Party.
I also felt it was a very old-fashioned campaign in the sense that it was very much, obviously it has to be a personality-led campaign, it's a mayoral one, but it was about his kind of competence, right? And about his, and it also bored journalists, which I think, like, when journalists are bored, then your message is finding it, like, well, who was he the son of? Oh, he's the son of a bus driver. But, you know, that they just had a couple of messages. I saw, you know, it was really funny to watch him on the Andrew Marr programme on Sunday because he obviously looked incredibly tired, had a cold. And it was like he was now just a sort of slot machine where if you press the button, he started talking about the fare freeze and he just kind of couldn't stop himself. But that means that that same stump speech has... And the other thing is that they had an enormous number of debates between the two of them. Like, this is really an election where the lines got really honed and he got really good at arguing against Zach, not that... It turns out that that was tough an ask, but in the sense of going out and having to fight your case, he's had a lot more experience than I think maybe a lot of candidates have had. Yeah,
and I think they did learn the lessons. George has written a very good piece on this. They did learn a lot of the lessons of the Ed era failure, one of which was an Ed loved to get a headline through announcing a policy, but you need to just repeat. Whereas they basically announced all of their policies in January and just repeated them. Very ruthlessly.
And they didn't complain about the media. And I know this is something that obviously as the media, a spokesman for the media, but I do think there is a really troubling strain at the moment that seeks to blame the media for not covering things in the way you would like, as if that's sort of kind of completely out of your hands as a political party, that you just can't do anything about it.
I mean, also the thing is, he did have, I think, far and away the most hostile press of any Labour candidate, yeah.
Flaming buckets of shite over him at regular intervals.
Yeah, the Daily Zach was, the Evening Zach was fairly... There was one day when it was like, you know, I finished my book, so I thought I'll read the Standard. Front page, Zach Goldsmith, I turned it over, back page, Spurs. And it was just like, oh, this is just, it's like a newspaper made of everything I hate in the world.
I mean, I do think it's worth saying, despite the relentless press hostility, which is always going to be there for any Labour mayoral candidate, whoever you want to attribute this victory to, Jeremy Corbyn, Sadiq Khan, whatever, it was not a perfect test of what wins, in the sense that he was up against a really lackluster campaign, quite aside from its nasty race baiting, I was about to say edges, but actually core.
I think the general kind of received wisdom now is that it had to be a nasty campaign because there was no candidate to sell, so you had to sell fear, right? Mm-hmm.
That might be true electorally. I don't think it makes it justifiable morally. But
No, that is a different issue. But you know what I mean is that I think they thought they were getting Boris and then they didn't get Boris and then they panicked and they kind of had to then go to like, what's number two in our armory? Okay.
I'm not convinced that's true. I think there was a strong, if still difficult to win campaign that the Tories could have run against Sadiq Khan as a kind of chameleon, a policy chameleon. So when he was the junior transport minister, he advocated repeatedly in the House of Commons for a third runway at Heathrow. Then when he decided he wanted to be London mayor, he started opposing a third runway at Heathrow. It looks like he might have in City Hall as his transport advisor Andrew Adonis, who was his boss as transport secretary, who was very much a fan of a third runway at Heathrow. At some point, the government is going to announce where they stand on a third runway at Heathrow. What is Sadiq Khan going to say? I mean, there's those kinds of issues, because Sadiq has been on a kind of circuitous political journey. He's taken in various different factions of the Labour Party, and that was the campaign the Tories should have run. They should have said, where does this man actually stand within the Labour Party? He nominated Jeremy Corbyn, voted for Andy Burnham, is now seems to be running from the right. There was a line of argument.
They could have got back that chameleon suit that, if you remember, Theo Bertram used to work in Number 10 and now works at Google, told a great anecdote during the election about them deciding to run a David Cameron is a chameleon costume, but they couldn't. He had to wear it while riding a bike, so they had to commission a special chameleon costume at enormous expense, and then it was very difficult to use. Somewhere out there is that chameleon costume. They could have dusted that off and bought that off the Labour Party.
Yeah, I think Henry is exactly right. And I think that Sadiq was in many ways a much more beatable campaign candidate. And instead, it basically became, the plural of anecdote isn't data, but this is very much the impression I've had when I've talked to people, not just in my own area, which is obviously a bit of a lefty bubble, but around London. Then it became a don't vote for that douchebag Goldsmith. Let's vote for the other guy. Whereas, you know, ultimately, then Sadiq managed to not just defeat Zach Goldsmith, but beat him quite handily in the area directly under the flight path. I mean, opposing Heathrow is like Zach Goldsmith's only thing, and he couldn't even get votes on that.
And he did decide that he was going to come out for Brexit, which, again, is one of those things where it's not like the London mayor is kind of in charge of that, so you might have just kind of could have played that slightly down a little.
So on one level, that was sincere of Goldsmith. We know he's a Brexiteer and he didn't moderate that for the London electorate, which is broadly pro-Europe. On the other hand, that was a silly thing to do campaigning.
Yeah, when business in London is big business, it's banks and it's big international companies. Okay, well, I think we've pretty like well chewed over those election results, have we? Don't tell me there's someone we missed. Don't make me do the Police and Crime Commissioner, Stephen.
The Police and Crime Commissioner.
What are the Police and Crime Commissioner? Vera Baird got re-elected. Yeah, the only one I heard of.
Vera Baird, who defended. The miners' families involved in Ogmore got re-elected, which is wonderful news. I mean, to be honest, what we've learned from police and crime commissioners is that you cannot just devolve power to areas where people do not have an immediate tribal identity, which I think is something to watch for next year when we have the first elections to, yes, Greater Manchester, yes, Merseyside, which do have a stronger identity, but also some slightly weird places drawn up in a map in Whitehall, like the West of England and Anglia. And on that wonkish final thought.
Top wonking. Thanks, Henry, for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bourke, and our music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.